Here is your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC still has the very best old-time radio on the live streaming. And if it's music you love, tune in to the RTC Music Channel, where this link and many others are on our website at oldtimeradiolisten.com. Now, here's Jim.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the RTC Weekly Download, where we listen to old-time radio. In fact, we think the best old-time radio. And we're going to spend about a little over an hour doing that today. I have an episode of the Phil Harris and Alice Faye Show to play for you. But first, we're going to listen to Behind the Mic. And the subject of Behind the Mic this week is warming up a studio audience. So we'll listen to that from 1940. And then the Phil Harris Alice Faye Show has something to do with warming up the audience too, because we do have the complete program, including the warm-up. And the Phil Harris and Alice Faye Show is from 1953, and it's about traffic problems in Los Angeles. So here we go with Behind the Mic.
Radio's own show, Behind the Mic. Radio. With a switch of a dial, radio brings you tragedy, comedy, entertainment, information, education. A whole world at your command. But radio isn't all on the surface. There are stories behind radio. Stories behind your favorite program and favorite personalities and radio people you never hear of. Stories as amusing, dramatic, and interesting as any make-believe stories you hear on the air. And that's what we give you, the human interest, the glamour, the tragedy, the comedy and information that is Behind the Mic. And now presenting the conductor of this program, a man whose name since the beginning of broadcasting has been a byword in radio, Graham McNamee.
Thank you, Gene Hamilton. Thank you. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience. First off, Behind the Mic presents Warming Up a Studio Audience. You folks at home have been missing something that has become a part of radio broadcast, and frankly, we don't think you should miss it. You see, you people listening to your radios are easy and relaxed, but when an audience comes into the studio, it is at first sometimes generally tense and nervous and possibly a little ill at ease. And now, since the audience plays an important part in any radio broadcast, making it feel at home and introducing it to certain details with which it can cooperate is very important. This is accomplished by doing what is known as warming up the studio audience. I don't have to tell you any more about that because we have the best warmer-upper in radio right here, the famous announcer, Harry Von Zell. And without any further ado, I'm going to call on him to show you what is meant by warming up a studio audience. Harry Von Zell. Hello, Harry. Hi.
I don't know that song, or I could sing a few bars of it to get started. Graham didn't say so, but I think I'd better mention that this sample of a warm-up speech that I'm going to do is the one that I've been doing with the Fred Allen Show. That's a comedy program. And before we go on, 5 or 10 minutes before we go on the air, I hobble out and start this speech. I say, ladies and gentlemen, we have but a very few moments before taking the air. And before that time, we'd like to welcome you here and express to you our thanks for the kind interest which prompts your visit to our broadcast. It's the usual procedure before going on the air for some little man like myself to hobble out and run through a brief recitation of the technical problems we face in the presentation of radio programs. We do that because your understanding of those problems and your cooperation can aid us immeasurably in meeting them. Of course, the most important element is the time element. You know, in radio, when your half hour is up, you go off whether you're ready or not. You can't hang over at the finish, you know. This fact has resulted in some very unsatisfactory finishes for radio programs. You probably have heard at some time or other some poor worried announcer signing off a program in very hurried fashion with words to the effect, "Don't forget to run out in the morning and buy a tube of National Broadcasting Company." It has happened, and of course that only results in bewildering the poor listener who naturally never had any idea that you could buy the National Broadcasting Company by the two. So we've naturally tried to avoid that by having as much flexibility as possible in the running time of the show. One means of achieving that desired flexibility is to seek your cooperation in the matter of applause. We ask that during the broadcast you allow us to give you a signal when it's time to stop applauding. We don't like you to overdo it. I think I had better add, too, so as to avoid any possible misunderstanding, that while we do cue the applause in the interest of saving time, there is at no time during the program any signal of any kind given when it's time to laugh. We wouldn't like to feel that if Mr. Allen or somebody here says something funny, that you were sitting there choking back gales of uproarious laughter waiting for someone here to tell you to let it fly. Quite to the contrary, any time you think you have heard anything funny, you just go ahead and react in any way that suits you best, be it either a giggle, titter, or guffaw. And at such times as that may happen, we here on the stage, a little surprised and very grateful, immediately stop whatever we're doing and hang around until you grow weary of laughing. Then we plunge blindly on into the next bit of hilarious higgledy-piggledy, hoping for more bursts of gay chortles throughout the show. Sometimes we get them and sometimes we don't. Well, we only have 30 seconds now before taking air. It's not as much fun as taking gas, but we sincerely hope that when you leave this studio tonight, you leave feeling that you have enjoyed one of the happiest hours of your life. Thank you very much. Thank you.
That was swell, Harry. I think by now you've got our audience just sizzling. What a pot of gold winner did with his prize money. One of the most popular shows in radio is the Pot of Gold program, conducted by orchestra leader Horace Heidt. For those of you who don't know, the feature of the program is this. Each week, a telephone number is selected somewhere in the United States. The lucky person is then phoned, and if somebody answers the phone, the person who was called becomes the recipient of at least $1,000. Tonight, we bring you a Pot of Gold prize winner of a year ago to ask him what he's done with the money he was awarded. Introducing Mr. Sidney Anthony of Stamford, Connecticut. Mr. Anthony, when did you win your pot of gold money?
October 17th, 1939. And my prize money amounted to $1,900.
As much as that?
Yes. You see, if your phone number is selected and called and nobody answers the phone, you receive only $100 instead of the $1,000. The extra $900 is added to the person's whose money is followed the next week. Week before, the person who had been phoned was not at home. I received the additional $900.
I suppose that money of yours came in mighty handy, didn't it?
It certainly did. Business had been going steadily downhill the past few years, and that made it even more welcome.
What business are you in?
The house moving business.
Mr. Anthony, what have you done with that $1,900 that rolled in so unexpectedly?
Well, Mr. McNamee, I manage our business. It's a sort of family affair, and I used some of the money to pay a few of the company bills. I also paid all my personal bills.
You certainly weren't wasting your money.
I don't think so. And then the rest of it put me on the way to achieve an ambition. I lost my home to a mortgagee about 3 years ago, and ever since I have wanted to build a new home in the same neighborhood. Well, with the rest of the pot of gold money, I bought a building lot, and since then have built a foundation, and someday I'm going to build the rest of the house.
Well, you certainly have proven wrong the old saying that unearned money never did anybody any good. Thank you, Mr. Anthony, very much for coming here today. Behind the Mic presents the story behind how a radio program influenced a listener. Standing at the microphone is one of radio's most talented writers, Jane West, the author of the popular daytime serial, The O'Neills. Jane Jane, that was the most interesting story you told me about the effect of your program on a listener. And I'd like you to tell it to our audience. Will you please?
Why, certainly, Graham. Not long ago, I went into a New York department store to buy some dresses. And one of the saleswomen, whom I knew, greeted me with, "Hello, Mrs. O'Neill. Is your program still on the radio?" I said, "Yes, we're still going along." And at that, a lady who was standing next to me said,
"Pardon me, I couldn't help overhearing. Are you really Mrs. O'Neill of the Radio O'Neill?"
"No, I'm not Mrs. O'Neill. I play the part of Mrs. Bailey in the story, and I also write the script."
Oh, then you wrote the words for the play. It's an important part in my life.
Why?
My life.
Why, how do you mean?
Won't you sit down a minute?
Well, I...
Please, I feel I've just got to tell you. You see, I used to live here in New York, and I was very happily married. And then my husband bought a very promising store in a little town upstate. And that's where our troubles began. I didn't know anybody in the town, and I was lonely and dreadfully unhappy. I even refused to try to make friends, and it seemed that my husband and I did nothing but quarrel. And finally, things got so bad between us that at last I went to see a lawyer about getting a divorce. And after telling him my story...
Well, the situation is unpleasant, probably for both of you. But I don't think it necessitates divorce. After all, you've been married happily for years. You have two lovely children. You know, divorce would mean a miserable existence for them especially. Now, why don't you go home and try to work out some sort of an adjustment?
While I was at the lawyer's that afternoon, a radio had arrived at our house. We hadn't had a radio since we moved from New York because the current in our new home was AC instead of DC. And a couple of days later, while I was still thinking over the lawyer's advice, I was fiddling around the radio, and just by accident, I tuned in on the O'Neills. And through sheer coincidence, it was the episode where Peggy O'Neill was contemplating divorcing her husband, and Mother O'Neill was advising her.
Peggy, dear, you've got to think more carefully before you take such a drastic step. It isn't easy to face the future alone after years of married happiness, love, and companionship. Your husband perhaps has made a mistake. Even say that he has. But have you made every effort possible to try to save your marriage, your home, and future for your children? Have you really tried to meet him halfway? Peggy, when you married Monty, you entered into a lifetime contract, for better or for worse. And you should honestly try to live up to that agreement, just as much as you would to a business contract. Darling, you must be more understanding, more unselfish, and more forgiving. More loving, and more willing to help.
I was fascinated. Mother O'Neill seemed to be talking to me. I could hardly wait to hear the following day's episode, which also concerned Peggy's proposed divorce. And I started to apply Mrs. O'Neill's advice to my own experience. I took an interest in the community and the people around me. I made friends, and I tried to understand my husband's problems. And make a long story short, I'd never want to live anyplace else from where I am. And I've never been so happy in all my life.
Thank you, Jane West, for a most interesting story. And thanks to you, Kate McComb, for your sympathetic characterization of Mother O'Neill. The story behind animals on radio programs. When a radio script calls for a hippopotamus, an African warthog, or a chickadee, instead of going out personally to enlist these animals for the sake of realism, the director generally calls upon one of a small group of men who specialize in animal sounds. Among these animal impersonators is our next guest, Donald Bain. Donald,
Exactly what animals can you imitate?
Oh, Graham, I can imitate everything from mosquitoes to elephants.
Mosquitoes to elephants?
Yes, in other words, from... to...
That's a good way to encourage fan mail from the zoo. What type of animal are you called upon to do most, Donald?
Well, most of the time, I'm a dog.
Donald, you're just being hard on yourself. But seriously, do you play all kinds of dogs?
Yes, and in all kinds of moods, too. You see, Graham, in a script, I may be called upon to be a friendly dog like this. A suspicious dog like this. Or a vicious dog like this. That last is a type of a dog that's just not smart to argue with.
Yes, especially as his arguments have teeth in them. You certainly must have studied dogs in various moods.
Yes, Graham, and any person who really knows dogs can tell exactly how they feel by the sounds that they make. When a dog feels he is being left behind and wants to go along with his master, he'll sound like this. And when he feels like playing, he'll sound like this.
Ladies and gentlemen, if any of you have your dogs listening to the radio, will you please explain to them that they're not listening to a highly successful canine, but merely a reasonable facsimile? Don, what other animals are you called on to imitate?
Well, I have not been entirely unsuccessful as a chicken.
Chicken.
And I was Joan Bett's pet canary bird on a Lux show. I had quite a run of pigeons on Mr. District Attorney and others last winter. They sounded like this. And last winter, I was a pet monkey on Lorenzo Jones for quite a while. Then, not long ago, they made a jackass of me on a Radio Gill show.
Well, what was the most difficult animal impersonation you ever had to do, Donald?
Well, I think it was the hardest role for me to play was a killer ape in one of the Shadow scripts. Mm. That was hard because whenever I do my imitations, I put my whole heart and soul into them, and it was terrific strain on my abdominal muscle.
Do you mind recreating that famous moment for us when you were the killer ape?
All right, here goes.
Well, you sure have me scared, Donald. That was mighty good. Several people in the back row here fainted, and a hysterical page boy had just been carried out in a straitjacket. And incidentally, if Gargantua is listening in, Donald was just fooling. Oddities in Radio. Presenting odd, amusing little true stories that help make radio sometimes funny, sometimes exasperating, but always interesting. This week's oddity. A few years ago, the Believe It or Not program fell on Christmas Day, and Bob Ripley thought it would be a good idea to interview a man on the show whose actual name was Santa Claus. After a great deal of investigation, Bob actually discovered a man whose real name was Santa Claus. He was a preacher down in the Ozarks who had not only never been in New York, but he'd never been in any big city. Arrangements were made to put the preacher on the train, and he was told that when he reached New York, the very day before the broadcast, if somebody failed to meet him, he was to telephone the office of Doug Storer, Ripley's manager. Well, after the arrival of the train, the man who was to meet Santa Claus at the station phoned Storer.
Hello? Yes, this store. Oh, I can't find him. You looked all over the station? Oh, well, that's okay. I gave him my phone number and told him if nobody picked him up to phone me here. It's 1 o'clock now. He ought to call any minute. You might as well come back to the office and wait for him here. 3 o'clock already. Good heavens. He should have phoned a couple of hours ago. Say, I wonder if anything's happened to him. Don, you sure you looked all over the station?
Yes, I have, Doug.
I'm starting to get worried. After all, this is the first time he's ever been in a big city. Say, this is getting awful.
You say, Doug, if he doesn't show up, we're going to be short one guest for tomorrow's program.
Yes, and it's too late to get another one now. I can't understand it. I'm going out to see our telephone operator. Say, Miss Evans, I haven't had a single phone call this afternoon. Hasn't anybody called me?
There hasn't been a single call, Mr. Stora. Tomorrow's Christmas, you know. Nobody's at their office.
Yes, but are you positive nobody's phoned?
Well, sure I'm positive. Oh, some practical joker did phone and kept pestering me all afternoon.
A practical joker?
Yes, I'd lift the phone and say, Douglas Stora's office, who is this, please? And someone would say, this is Santa Claus. The last time he called, I got through and said, well, I'm Cleopatra, and hung up.
Doug, did you ever find Santa Claus?
Yes, Graham. About 10 minutes later. 10 minutes later, he phoned once again, and this time asked if I was there and told him, and I said, where are you? And he said, I'm still down at the Pennsylvania Station. I said, for Pete's sake, stay where you are and don't move. I'll send a man right down to get you. And Graham, when the man got down there, he found Santa Claus had taken my words literally. He was still in the telephone booth where he had been all afternoon trying to get me. And you can bet your life, Graham, we didn't let him out of our sight until the next night when he appeared on the Believe It or Not program.
Thank you very much, Doug Storer. You did a great job acting the part of yourself. So long, Doug. Each week, we invite the listeners of Behind the Mic to write us questions about radio. And the three or four we consider to be of most general interest, we have answered on the air by the radio editor of some outstanding newspaper or magazine. Tonight's questions will be answered by E.L. Bragdon, radio editor of the New York Sun. Mr. Bragdon, Mr. Roger Neely of New Brunswick, New Jersey, has this question to ask. He writes, the other night I was listening to the Aldrich family, and a few hours later I was fiddling around with my set and got a California station. Much to my surprise, I heard the Aldrich family again, doing exactly the same program I had heard a few hours before. Was this a recording I listened to the second time?
No, Mr. Neely, it was not a recording. You heard what is known as a repeat broadcast. Many radio programs are broadcast from the East early in the evening. They repeat the same broadcast later because of the difference in time between the East and the West Coast. For instance, the Aldrich family was broadcast at 8:30 Eastern Daylight Saving Time, which would be heard in California at 4:30 Pacific Coast Time. This would be too early in the afternoon to reach the same size audience as had listened to the program in the East. So the Aldrich family repeats the same broadcast at 12:30 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time for the West Coast only, where it is heard at 8:30 Pacific Coast Time. This is a very common procedure.
Our second question is from Mr. Armand Elbaum of Wichita, Kansas. He writes, I hear the expression ad-libbing used on the air every once in a while. Then I have read that Fred Allen and Jack Benny are great ad-libbers. Will you please tell me exactly what is the meaning of ad-libbing?
Well, ad-libbing actually comes from the Latin ad libertum, which means at liberty. A radio performer or any performer is said to be ad-libbing when he does not follow the prepared script and speaks lines which presumably he had thought up on the spur of the moment. Fred Allen is said to be a great ad-libber because when a situation arises on a program that was not foreseen when the original script was written, he is expert at improvising funny lines to meet the situation.
Thank you, Mr. Bragdon, for answering all those questions. Behind the Mic presents the story behind the story behind the mic. Standing at the microphone is a pleasant, thick-set gentleman whose broadcasts by shortwave probably go to more countries than any commercial broadcast on the air. The gentleman, heard three times each week over NBC, is Captain Tim Healy, conductor of Captain Tim Healy's Stamp Club of the Air.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Captain Tim, exactly what was this broadcast you did? The one that had that strange result.
Well, Graham, back in 1935, I told the following spy story on the air. During the visit of the Kaiser to London in 1913, the British Intelligence Department assigned various officers to watch the visitors. Now, they were not to spy on them, you understand, Graham, but to guard them and keep them out of trouble. One night, shortly before midnight, a Secret Service officer who was disguised as a footman in Buckingham Palace rapped on the window to call the attention of another Secret Service officer outside.
What is it?
General von Tabor is leaving the palace.
Right, I'll keep an eye on him.
The general drove off in a taxi, followed at not too great a distance by the officer, also in a taxi. The general's taxi twisted and turned through the streets as if, well, he was trying to shake off any possible pursuit. A maneuver which, incidentally, was not successful. Finally, about midnight, the general drove up before a barber's shop in North London. He got out of the taxi and, after looking about very carefully, knocked at the barber's door.
Oh, Dummkopf. Hey, what is los mit Ihnen? What's the idea of keeping me waiting here?
Oh, I'm very sorry, General.
Well.
The intelligence officer hung around the outside of the barber shop, and it was an hour before the general emerged. The general was then driven back to Buckingham Palace. The intelligence officer thought this very strange, and he told his chief. And his chief thought it was rather strange. Upon investigations, it was discovered that the barber shop was owned by a man named Carl Ernst, a naturalized British subject. The chief assigned different officers every day to hang around the barber shop and see if there was anything in the barber's actions to arouse suspicion. One day the chief himself was in the barber shop waiting to get shaved when the postman entered and threw a large brown envelope on the table.
Hello, Carl.
Oh, hello. Got something for me?
Yes, here's your money from Germany.
I wish it was. Goodbye.
Righto. I say barber. I'll be back in a few minutes.
Oh, but you're next.
Yes, but I must get a check cashed to the bank, and it's almost closing time. On my place for me.
All right, I will.
I say there, postman. Postman, I want a word with you. Oh, blimey, I want to deliver these letters and,
Scotland Yard, eh?
Yes. Let's pop into this pub for half a moment.
All right.
Now, first, as a loyal British subject, I want you to keep your mouth shut about whatever I ask you.
You don't have to worry about me.
That big brown envelope you brought into the barber shop. Does the barber get letters like that often?
Depends on what you might call often. He gets one of these envelopes regularly. I should think about once a month.
Oh.
The chief then arranged with the post office department for the next of those letters to be delivered to him. And when it was delivered to him, the envelope was opened by a secret process known to military intelligence, opened in such a way that it could be closed without the tampering being detected. As soon as that letter was opened, they discovered 26 letters within that brown envelope. The letters seemed rather harmless enough, but when they were decoded...
Gentlemen, this one is addressed to a German agent in Portsmouth. They want to know the disposition of our fleet there. This one is to an agent in Manchester. They want to know about the production capacity of one of the munition factories. It is all undoubtedly clear that Carl Ernst is acting as a kind of spy post office. These letters are sent to him in this big envelope from Germany. Then he mails the individual letters himself using English stamps, and the letters are then postmarked in England. And so the agents are not suspected of receiving mail from Germany. We'll just keep an eye on our Mr. Ernst.
The British intelligence kept their eye on Mr. Ernst and on 26 German agents so well that when the war was declared in 1914, they were all immediately clapped into jail. So that Germany was in complete darkness concerning the British troop and naval movements the few first months of the war.
What happened to Ernst and the other agents?
Well, Graham, of course, they paid the penalty for being spies. Now, Graham, what makes this story so strange is this. The day after I told this on the air, I received a telephone call from a gentleman who'd heard the broadcast, and he asked me to give him an interview. I did, and he told me a very strange story. He had been in complete ignorance as to what had happened to his grandfather, who had disappeared in England more than 20 years before, until he had heard my broadcast. His grandfather, Graham, had been Carl Ernst.
Thank you, Captain Tim Healy, for a very interesting and a mighty entertaining tale. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions about the inside of radio that you wish answered on the air, write a letter to us. Address it to Graham McNamee, Behind the Mic, National Broadcasting Company, New York City. As many questions as possible will be answered by mail. And the three or four questions we feel to be of most general interest will be answered on this program. Thank you. This is Graham McNamee speaking. Good afternoon, all.
Next Sunday, Behind the Mic will be heard at 6:05 Eastern Standard Time, and thereafter at 5:30. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
Now it's back in time to November 27th, 1953, for an episode of the Phil Harris Alice Faye Show with the warm-up. Here is traffic problems in Los Angeles.
Ladies and gentlemen, our announcer and the grand boy, William Forrest.
First of all, I'd like to welcome you good people on behalf of our sponsor. We are one of the few remaining radio shows that's lucky enough to have a sponsor. So if you enjoy yourself during the next half hour, you could do us all a big favor if you would. And that is sometime this week, stop by your neighborhood RCA record dealer, pick up a 27-inch television set or a record player or something. Because we'd like to be working up here next year at the same time. I don't know whether you know it or not, but throughout the country, with the exception of Los Angeles, we have a new time this year. We're heard on Friday evening. Excuse me. And also you know that Phil is out on his own for the first time. So what do you say we all get together and give a great big welcome to the man who discovered the South, Phil Harris. Gentlemen, I can't tell you how much it means to me to have me come out here all by myself, and you're all smiling and applauding and glad to see me, and I just want to tell you I love you for it because I need it. I've been with Jack Benny for 16 years, and there ain't no money connected with that guy. What Jack does on Saturday night is take you in a dark room, gives you one fast course of love and bloom, and you've had it, Clyde. Anything you can do to help me earn an honest living, I'll certainly appreciate it. I got off to a bad start when I married Alice. They told me she had money, but I'll be damned if I can. Looked everywhere. He said, maybe your brother's got it. I went with him 2 months. Really tragic, you know? Hey, it's awful nice to see you guys, you service guys in the audience, and I just want you to know that you can come to my show anytime, because, ladies and gentlemen, the servicemen are the finest audiences we have. And it's... I'm partial to the Navy because I was in the Navy during the last war myself. That's right, partial. I fought the Battle of Catalina. You're laughing. We lost 8 lobster traps over there. Well, the officers didn't eat. They blamed us. You know, the water came up and took them away. But they had a very unique way of selecting their enlisted men when I went into the Navy according to what they'd done in private life. See, they were particular in those days. So I went in with a couple of buddies of mine, and one of them was a street cleaner, and they put him on a minesweeper. Yeah. And this other buddy of mine was a construction guy. He tore down stuff and carried it off, see? So they put him on a destroyer. How I ever wound up on a ferry boat, I'll never mind. You're going to be a good group tonight. Hey, did you hear the story about the guy walked in the barbershop, said, how many ahead of me? The barber says, 3. The guy went out, he don't come back. Next day, he comes in again, says, the barber, how many ahead of me? The barber says, 3. The guy walks out, he don't come back.
Now, the barber's going nuts. You know, he's up all day on his feet and the clink of them scissors and all. You know, the guy. Good. Oh, that's the Chinese grip system, see? So the guy, he don't know. So the barber, you know, he finally gets all worked up every time the guy goes out. So he walks out the bootblack. The barber does. He says to bootblack, he says, look, every day a guy comes in, wants to know how many head. I tell him he goes out, he don't come back. He says, if he does it tomorrow, follow him. I want to know. Next day, the guy came in, says to the barber, how many head of me? The barber says, three. The guy walks out, the bootblack follows him, comes back in about 20 minutes. The barber says, where'd he go? Where'd he go? The bootblack says, to your house. Wrong union. You know what happened? Here by the drunk that fell out of the 12-story building, this guy's blind drunk. You know, he's away from home on a loot. And he falls out of this building. It's 12 stories high, and he's drunk, and he falls out, and boom, he hits the sidewalk. There's a big crowd around. He gets up, brushed himself off. Fellow walks up, says, what happened? He says, damn fine, oh, I just got here. Oh, we're rolling now. Drunks walking down a railroad track, both of them blind. They're walking down a railroad track. The one drunk looks at the other and says, man, that's the longest staircase I ever came down. The other one says, I don't mind that. It's these low banisters. They were on wine. You know, whatever little success, ladies and gentlemen, we've attained, I'd like to tell you is to unite people listening to our program and also for our organization. We have, ladies and gentlemen, one of the finest working organizations I think that is possible to obtain, and I'm very thankful because in our business, one or two people can't do it. You must have a very fine functioning organization, and we're very well. For instance, everyone you see sitting on that stand does an outstanding job on his or her particular instrument. See, the things that I know that you don't. I take the leader, he's okay. We're very proud of him, inasmuch as we have a genius on our hands, and I am I'm speaking the truth now. He has already had two of his own compositions played in the Hollywood Bowl. He has been nominated 6 times for motion pictures for the Academy Award. He was nominated last year for the beautiful conducting and arranging of all the wonderful music that you heard in the Hans Christian Andersen story, and just missed the Academy Award by a few votes. This year, he's just finished another big picture, and we're all keeping our fingers crossed. He just did a picture called The French Line, and he is now doing the new, process of making the new Martin and Lewis picture, so this kid's going like a bear. This is Walter Sharp in New York. That's all handwork, no sergeant. You know, I'm very happy about the guys in the band. Most of these fellas have been around me for many, many years, ladies and gentlemen, because I started as an alleged musician. I was a drummer. They led us in the union. That's about all you can say for it. But I did have an opportunity of meeting a lot of wonderful guys and a lot of wonderful people, and we've held our friendship over these many years. Every fella sitting up there has done something outstanding in our music business, and as much as most of them have been with I'd say all of the big Dixieland bands and all of the important bands in the United States. They now have families, and they're out here in other businesses, and they come with me today. But I have a couple of them I could introduce you and tell you the history of every boy that would be interesting, but we don't have the time, but there's a couple of them I'd like for you to meet. One of them you hear every night. Tonight he'll be on KNBH and does a wonderful job and is one of our outstanding orchestra leaders in the whole United States. Albino Ray, ladies and gentlemen. Another fellow, we used to room together years ago. I'm not going to tell you how many, but he too has been very, very successful. He is known as a musician in his particular line of business, in his particular type of music. His records, some records that he made 15, maybe 18 years ago, are collector's items. He's still making records, and he will go down in history as one of the greatest exponents of Dixieland jazz, Red Nichols, the Red Nichols. Bill Foreman, our announcer. I'll introduce him like he's Now we get into, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to have you meet somebody. Without her, this program wouldn't be possible. I'm not going into a big eulogy. I'm just going to tell you I've been married to her for 12 years, and we have two beautiful children, and she's not only the most beautiful gal in the world, but didn't get that a lot of talent. Alice Beck! She's got ankles like Lady's Dancer, isn't she? Wow, nuts about me. Here I am. Here are the two little girls who play the part of Alice and Phyllis on our program. They, too, are two of the most competent little actresses we have in this business. One of us at the present time over making a picture with Bing Crosby in White Christmas, and we're all pulling for her. Say hello to Janine Roos and Ann Whitfield, ladies and gentlemen. They don't come too young for me.
You know, a barking dog never bites.
We have three guests, and I want you to be awfully nice to them because they're very important guys, and I am very thankful that they came over to work on my program. Because they, too, are well-known in pictures, all of them, and they do a lot of important things in our field of acting. The first one has been with us before. It's awfully nice to have him back again, and I want you to be awfully nice to him. Say hello to Dick Halloran, ladies and gentlemen. Kevin Costner's been on our program, not this year, but several times last year, and we hope to have him back again a lot because we're always assured of a fine performance, Mr. Dick Ryan. Here's a fellow that's been a friend of mine for many, many years. We used to shoot stuff together up out of Bakersfield, and we used to have a lot of fun, and it's awfully nice to be able to renew old acquaintances. He has one of our outstanding actors, ladies and gentlemen, in Hollywood for quite a number of years, Mr. Douglas Dumbruth. I don't know about that. Cody ain't going to shoot no Douglas. He can wear anything, this cat. He comes on. Now, I want you to meet the little fella that steals our show every week, and we're happy because he's got a lot of talent. He plays the part of Julius Abruzzo, the grocery boy, Walter Catley. And the one and only Elliot Lewis. Thanks, ladies and gentlemen, for coming to see us. Mainly, thanks for being so nice, and I certainly hope you enjoy the program. And what I'm trying to say is, for God's sake, laugh.
But soft, what light through yonder window breaks? 'Tis the east, and Juliet is the sun. Oh, Harris, you ought to be pitching for the Yankees. You've got so much on the ball.
RCA Victor, world leader in radio, first in recorded music, and first in television, presents the Phil Harris Alice Faye Show. For your enjoyment, here is the Phil Harris Alice Faye Show, transcribed, written by Ed James and Lou Derman, with Elliot Lewis, Walter Tetley, John Hubbard, Janine Roos, Ann Whitfield, Walter Sharpness music, and yours truly, Bill Foreman. Tonight, we bring you a bright little gem entitled The Traffic Problem in Los Angeles, or Dante's Inferno. Now the stars of the RCA Victor program, Alice Faye and Bill Harris. When the average husband refers to his better half, he means his wife, but not Phil Harris. to fill his better half is his left profile. Or is it his right? Well, anyway, here he comes with both profiles shining and a full set of teeth to match.
Two loves have I, it's a perfect parlay. My wife's a doll, but I love RCA.
Oh, hiya, honey. What are you looking at?
Oh, Phil, the prints of our new pictures just arrived.
Oh, they did, huh? Well, let's mail them out and let's not keep all that beauty to ourselves.
Hey, they look pretty good, don't they?
I see them. Gosh, you look wonderful, Alice. Just wonderful.
Oh, thank you, kind sir, she said.
Well, I don't know about me. Somehow, pictures don't do me justice.
Why, Phil?
No, honey, I mean it. Now, look at this one. Look, he's got that boyish twinkle in my eyes, but... Well, he didn't capture my lovable, devil-may-care smile.
You mean your wolfish leer?
No, I mean the magnetic charm that makes me irresistible to all females between 16 and 60.
Is that their age or their IQ?
Now, take it easy, will you, Brenda? You married me, didn't you? Don't that show that I attract the brainy type?
Duh. Hey, Bob.
Hey, do that again, Alice, will you? That reminds me of a dame I used to go with in Nashville.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, honey. No, I'm not. You should have seen her. Red hair, blue eyes, and skin like a 10-year-old.
How old was she?
10 years old. Of course, I was only 11 at the time. In them days, I was known as Marshmallow Harris, toast of the campfire girls. Them was the days.
Say, Phil.
Yeah.
Speaking of girls, which you somehow always manage, what do you suppose happened to ours? They should have been home from school an hour ago.
Maybe they got too smart and the teacher's keeping them in to give them some more stupid pills. It happens. Phyllis told me. She said she would have had straight A's last month if it wasn't for them stupid pills.
Oh, I don't know. Those girls tell you anything and you believe it.
Honey, wait a minute. Phyllis got a D in English, didn't she? And you know no daughter of mine ain't getting no D in English if they ain't giving her no stupid pills.
Phil, what's a coquette?
A what?
A coquette.
It's a small coke. Why?
Just testing.
Alice, I happen to know this English language like a native. So go ahead. Test me again. Ask me anything.
All right. What's a silhouette?
It's a small salute. Thought I didn't know, huh?
And a baguette?
A baguette? Well, that'd be a baguette's a small girl. You know, honey, they didn't hand out none of them stupid pills when I went to school.
Well, they handed out something.
Hi, everybody. We're home.
Well, it's about time you kids got here. Where you been?
Girls, you know I worry every time you don't come straight home from school.
But we did, Mom.
You just can't get across Ventura Boulevard, that's all.
Well, why don't you cross with the light?
There isn't any light at White Oaks.
And every time you try to cross, the cars begin chasing you. But we fool them. We keep running back and forth.
Had a girl. That's the way to do it. Don't give them a chance to aim. Just... Don't they have a crosswalk at White Oak?
It's all rubbed out.
Well, how about the safety zone?
Honey, them things are pickup stations for the Blue Cross. About the only way to get on the other side of Ventura Boulevard is to be born there.
You ought to be done about it.
Well, what happened to that petition that Willie got up for a light at White Oak? Didn't everybody sign it?
Well, the city said the funds were all gone.
Oh, fine, fine, funds. A big city like this and they can't shell out for one puny light.
I know somebody can fix it. Sniffy.
Sniffy?
She thinks he's so wonderful.
He's a district attorney, isn't he?
Some district attorney.
All right, wait a minute. Sniffy is the district attorney? How could a 15-year-old kid be
Well, look, honey, it's Boys Week, and Sniffy's father appointed him honorary district attorney.
Oh, well. He's anything like his father, he'll be a big help.
My boyfriend is the assistant fire chief.
Some boyfriend.
And he can get a light faster than any old district attorney, I bet you.
He can not.
All right, kids.
What good's an old district attorney?
He isn't old any better than any old fire chief.
He isn't either.
He certainly is.
Will you cut it, kids?
He is, too.
Alice,
it is.
Phyllis, will you stop that? Stop it.
Pardon me, is this the contented hour?
Hello, Elliot. Come on in.
Hi, Uncle Elliot.
Hi.
What's up? I could hear you clear down the driveway.
Uncle Elliot, isn't a district attorney better than a fire chief?
Assistant fire chief.
All right, girls,
that's
all
right. Even worse.
It isn't either.
Okay, that does it. Upstairs, the both of you.
But, Dad...
You heard your father. Upstairs.
But, Mom...
Not another word.
Gee whiz. You and your district attorney think he's so wonderful.
He's better than your old fire chief.
He isn't either.
He is, too.
He isn't.
He is, too.
He isn't.
He
isn't.
He isn't.
He isn't.
Good thing I had the bottle glued on that tape.
What are they doing? Trying out for What's My Line?
Elliot, Alice and I have something we'd like to discuss.
Go ahead. I won't say anything. I'll just listen.
Wait a minute, honey. Wait a minute. Elliot.
Hmm?
You know, sometimes a married couple likes to be alone.
They do?
How would you like it if you were married to Alice and I was around all the time?
Let's try it that way for a while.
All right.
Do have a problem. There's no traffic light at White Oak, and Alice and Phyllis have a terrible time getting across the street.
Why do they have to cross the street?
To get on the other side.
Oh, Curly. Joe Miller would be proud of you.
It ain't a joke.
He thought it was.
Elliot, the school's on the other side.
Nah, that's ridiculous. Who ever heard of a chicken going to school?
What chicken?
The one that crossed the street to get to the other side.
Alice, can I see you out in the garage?
What's going on out in the garage?
Elliot, now look, honey, this is a very serious problem.
Oh, okay, let's all go out in the garage.
It's got nothing to do with the garage. Alice and Phyllis can't cross the street because there isn't any traffic light.
Why don't they use the crosswalk?
Because there isn't any crosswalk.
Okay, let's paint one.
Now look, Elliot, listen to me. Don't...
Still. Wait a minute.
You don't have to say a word to me, honey. I promised you, and I'm not getting mixed up in any more of his crazy ideas. You
but
don't have
to... But it's a good idea. I like
Rocket
it.
Rocket ship to the moon, uranium and... You what?
I think Elliot's idea is very good.
Oh, honey, you better get some sleep. Lie down right over here. Now, take it easy. Just rest
oh,
a minute.
No, stop it, Phil. There's nothing wrong with me, and there's nothing wrong with Elliot's idea.
But every other time Elliot's had an idea,
You've gotten into trouble, I know. But how can you possibly get into trouble painting a few white lines?
She's right, Curly.
I don't know.
It doesn't take any brains. A 3-year-old child can paint a white line.
You see, Curly, it's right down our alley. All we need is some paint and a couple of brushes.
I got a feeling that something's going to happen. But let's go paint some lines.
Boy, look at them cars. There must be a million of them.
Look at them later, will you? We got to get these lines painted.
Okay, Mr. Rembrandt. Where we start?
Right at the corner. Now, you start on this side, and I'll go across the street, and we'll both work toward the middle. Got it?
Got it. And Curly, look out!
That guy almost killed me.
Did you see him snarl when he missed?
Yeah.
minutes. Look, Elliot.
Huh?
I'll start over here, and you go across the street.
Okay. And Curly?
Look out!
Curly, why don't we just paint lines on this side?
Elliot, why do you ask so many stupid questions?
That's stupid?
Sure it's stupid. We're supposed to paint a crosswalk all the way across. If we only put lines on one side of the street, it's no good. We'll have all this paint left over.
Well, we could paint a couple of lines down the middle. A straight one for men drivers and a zigzag one for lady drivers.
We're going to paint a crosswalk.
Okay, let's start painting.
All right, now, move over there about 10 feet, and then we'll paint across together.
Right, you just give me the notice.
All right. On your mark, get set, go! Elliot, Elliot.
Yes, Curly?
Let's talk this thing over.
Okay.
If we can't get out into the road, we can't paint the lines, can we?
That seems like a reasonable supposition.
And every time we step off the curb, we get chased by a car. Right?
Dead
right. That's what I'm afraid of. Now, there's only one sensible way to do this. One of us has to paint, and one of us has to act as a decoy.
A decoy?
Yeah.
What's a decoy?
A decoy? Well, it's like, look, one of us stands in the middle of the road and the cars all aim at him. So they don't notice the other guy, who is quietly painting.
You mean the guy that's out there ducking cars? That's a decoy.
Yeah. One of us.
You wouldn't have any ideas about which one of us.
Good luck, Elliot.
So long, Curly. Just remember, I'm doing this for your wife and kids. Your wife and kids.
Ha-ha, you missed me!
You have much painting done, Curly?
Well, if it ain't Crazy Legs Hirsch.
Back in that old fake roo, didn't
I? Yeah, man, you were spinning in and out.
How's the painting coming along?
Are you kidding? I didn't even get the brush wet.
Fine. I'm getting chased all over the boulevard, and you go to sleep on the job.
Are you kidding? You weren't gone 2 seconds.
In 2 seconds, how could I get 10 years older?
Oh, now, look. Let's try it again, and try to stay out there a little longer.
Oh, wait a minute.
Huh?
Wait, Curly. Just hold it.
Now what's the matter?
I got a better idea. People get killed even in crosswalks, don't they?
Sure, but it ain't considered cricket.
If cricket schmick it, they get knocked for a loop. You know what we do?
What?
We dig a tunnel.
Elliot.
It's a very practical idea.
I don't know,
look,
but...
Look, Curly... Do they have crosswalks over the Hudson River?
No.
Do they have tunnels under the Hudson River?
Well, sure.
Then why ain't it a good idea?
I ain't said it wasn't. I just don't think that Alice is going to like it, that's all.
She liked the crosswalk, didn't she? And this is better, believe me.
Well, I don't know. But Elliot, where are you going?
You stay right there, Curly. I got to borrow a pick and shovel.
How you doing, Elliot?
Hey, I'm not kidding, Curly. This is tough work. I'm getting a blister.
Ah, what are you worried about? Another couple of 100 feet and you'll be all through. Go ahead, Roy. Keep digging. Let me hear it up here. Dig it out.
All right. Hey, Curly?
Yeah?
There's another flock of wires down here.
What kind?
Same as last time. Bell telephone.
Pull them out.
All of them?
Sure. What do we want with telephone wires? Now, if they was electric wires leading to an RCA Victor television set with a 27-inch screen, that'd be different.
You mean RCA Victor television sets work good in tunnels?
Good. They even work in a cave. Peter the Hermit's got one in every room. Nothing.
But these are telephone wires, so I chop them out, right?
Right.
Okay. Chop, chop.
Attaboy, Elliot, you're doing fine.
Well, and how are you this fine evening?
Oh, hello, officer. Beautiful night, isn't it?
You and your friend lost something?
Oh, no. We're just taking a hole.
Hey, Curly, here's the wire.
Okay, toss it out.
Yep.
Attaboy. It's just some old telephone wires we chopped out, officer.
I see.
Hey, Curly, I gotta rest for a minute. Oh, hello, officer.
Would you mind telling me exactly what you're doing?
Well, when we started, we were painting the crosswalk.
8 feet under the ground?
No. No, you see, my friend here explained to me that they didn't have any crosswalks over the Hudson River, but they had lots of tunnels. So we decided to dig one.
Oh, this is going to be a tunnel under the Hudson River, is that it?
Officer, they have tunnels like this all over the world. Like in Germany, under the Autobahn.
And you're digging a spare.
You've got a great sense of humor, Andy. No, officer, look. Biscuit sharp as a biscuit. No, look, you don't understand, officer. You see, I've got two little girls, and they have to cross the road.
Like Joe Miller's chicken.
But there's no light here.
So we're digging a tunnel instead.
You're digging a tunnel under Ventura Boulevard?
You know a better way to get across?
We could build a bridge, but a tunnel's so much more practical.
Especially when it rains.
Yeah.
Well, you keep digging your tunnel, boy. I've got to make me call into the station.
Yeah, all right. So long, officer. It was nice talking to you.
Yeah, you come back any time.
Hey, he was a nice guy, wasn't he? Yeah, he's got
a help. Hello, Tim. This is Mike. Send the wagon. I've got a couple of doozies.
I'll only stay a few minutes.
All right, Mrs. Harris. You'll find your husband in cell 2. That's the bridal suite.
Thank you. The bridal suite?
Yes, ma'am. That has twin straitjackets.
Oh, Phil. You were supposed to paint 2 little lines.
Honey, it's all a mistake. We'll be out of here in no time.
Wait till I tell my congressman. Just wait.
What am I going to tell the girls? Their father's a jailbird.
Now, don't worry, Alice. I'll be out the first thing in the morning.
If they hadn't have taken away the pick and shovel, we could have been out of here tonight.
Honey, I brought your pajamas and your toothbrush.
Oh, thanks, honey, but it's not that bad. This ain't a bad jail. It's nice and warm.
Well, I'd better go, Phil.
Can't you stay a few more minutes?
But the girls...
No sense going out in the cold when you could stay here in a nice, comfortable jail.
Phil, I ought to go home.
Honey, please.
I simply can't stay.
Baby, it's cold outside.
I've got to go away.
Baby, it's cold outside.
This evening has been
hoping that you'd drop
so
in.
Very warm.
I'll hold your hands there just
my
like
mother will start to worry.
Beautiful, what's your
and
hurry?
And father will be pacing the floor.
Listen to the fireplace
so
roar.
Really, I'd better scurry.
Beautiful, please don't
well, maybe
hurry.
Just a half a drink more.
Put some records on while I
the
bowl.
Neighbors may think,
baby, it's bad out there.
Say, what's in
no
this drink?
No cabs to be had out there.
I wish I knew
your
how
eyes are like starlight
to break
now
the spell.
I'll take your hat, your hair looks
I
swell.
Ought to say no,
mind
sir.
If I'm moving
at
closer?
At least I'm gonna say that I tried.
What's the sense of hurting my pride?
I really can't stay.
Oh, baby, don't hold out.
Oh, but it's cold outside. I simply must
baby,
go.
It's
the answer is
but
no.
Baby, it's cold outside.
The welcome has
how
been.
How lucky that you dropped
so
in.
So nice and warm.
Look out the window at
my
that storm.
My sister will be suspicious.
Gosh, your lips look delicious.
My brother will be there at the door.
Waves along the tropical
my
shore.
My maiden aunt's mind is vicious.
Gosh, your lips are delicious.
Well, maybe just a cigarette more.
Never such a blizzard before.
I've gotta get
but
home.
But baby, you'll freeze out there.
Say, lend me a
it's
comb.
Up to your knees out there.
For oh, you've really been grand.
I thrill when
but
you touch
you
me.
And
how can you do this thing
there's
to me?
There's bound to be talk tomorrow.
Think of my lifelong
at least
sorrow.
There will be plenty in
if you get pneumonia and
die, I really can't stay.
Get over it, baby.
Oh, but
it's cold outside.
The court will rise.
Hey, Curly. I'm getting worried.
Oh, worried about what? We didn't do nothing. What's wrong with digging a tunnel?
Quiet over there.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, sir.
Municipal Court of the Los Angeles Judicial District, Division 32. The Honorable Robert Anderson presiding is now in session. Be seated.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, this is Boys Week, and so assisting me on the bench will be a representative elected to this office by the student body of the Encino High School. My colleague and associate, the Honorable Julius Abruzzio.
Julius!
Help!
Proceed, Judge Abruzzio.
It's a pleasure, Your Honor. Bailiff?
Yes, Your Honor.
What's the first ducat on the docket?
People versus Phil Harris and Elliot Lewis. Charge destroying public property.
I find them guilty and sentence them to life imprisonment.
Wait a minute. Hey, wait a minute.
Julius, it's us, your friends.
Step down.
Judge Abruzzio, may I confer with you for one moment?
Okay, Your Honor. Everybody hold it a second. My honor's going to confer with his honor. Yes, Your Honor?
Judge Abruzzio, before we sentence the defendants, don't you think it might be a good idea to hold the trial?
But, Judge, I know these guys. We'd be letting them off right if we executed the both of them.
I object on the grounds that he's irrelevant, immaterial, and unconstitutional.
According to the 21st Amendment.
The 21st Amendment? That repeals prohibition.
Yeah, wasn't that a beauty?
Quiet, or I'll have you put in solitary. You want to, can I clip these jokes for contempt of court?
Well, by all means.
Oh, Julius, you wouldn't do a thing like that, would you?
Now look, you little fink.
$20 for contempt of court.
What?
And $20 for asking questions.
$40, please.
Pay the man, Curly.
You and your tunnels. Here.
Judge Abruzzio, shall we proceed?
We have to.
Well, Julius, the courts of this country are designed to protect the innocent as well as to punish the wrongdoer. In our democracy, every man is deemed innocent until proven guilty.
Well, let's prove him guilty and get it over with. Who's the face witness?
The arresting officer, Your Honor.
Hiya, Mike!
Hello, Junior.
Oh, we're in great shape.
$20 for opening your yap.
I object.
And $20 for objecting.
$40, please. Thank you.
Oh, don't mention it. Don't mention it.
Swear in the witness.
You swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? I do.
Proceed, Your Honor.
Mike, what were these criminals doing when you found them?
Digging a hole.
I object. It was a tunnel.
Now you did it. It opens by itself.
Where'll I get you outside, you little creep?
Elliot, will you stop it? Stop!
That'll be $50 more.
We must have moved to a higher court.
$70, please.
What are we doing? Buying the courthouse? Now what did I say?
$100 for trying to bribe an officer.
Proceed, Judge Abruzzio.
Mike, would you say that these murderers was under the influence?
We didn't say nothing.
We didn't even move.
Spoil sports.
Judge Abruzzio, are you implying that these men have been known to indulge?
Indulge? They indulge till they bulge.
Mr. Harris.
Yes, Your Highness.
According to the complaint, you and this other gentleman...
Gentlemen, now I object.
$20, please.
That wasn't
me. I didn't say nothing. That was Julia.
Oh, stop quibbling, for goodness sake.
Mr. Harris?
Yes, sir?
I recognize the spirit which prompted your action.
Recognize it? You can bottle it.
But we cannot have the people taking matters into their own hands. After all, what would we have if everyone decided to dig his own tunnel?
Live pedestrians.
He broke it.
I'm afraid the court can do nothing but find you both guilty as charged.
But, Your Honor...
Judge Abruzzio will pass sentence.
Alcatraz, get ready. Mr. Harris?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Lewis?
You just wait, you little crumb.
I sentence you to 160 years of hard labor.
Julius, Your Honor, all we did was dig a hole.
Judge Abruzzio, the penalty in a case of this type is generally a fine.
You mean I can't have them executed? Not even one of them?
I'm afraid not.
Gee whiz.
According to my calculations, we need another $210.
$210? For what?
I fined him $210.
Now, wait a minute. That's $500 for digging one little hole?
Not exactly. It's $500 to install one traffic light at Ventura and White Oaks.
This is Phil again. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen and boys and girls, we've tried to have a little fun with the traffic problem, and we hope we gave you a few laughs. But we'd also like to remind you that the holiday season is coming up, and that means a lot of added traffic on foot and in cars. So let's all try to take it a little easy, especially around the schools. When we're driving, let's watch those traffic lights and crosswalks, because they'll be there, so look for them. Let's all be careful and have a real happy holiday this year. Good night, everyone. Say good night to the people, honey.
Good night, everybody.
That's my girl.
Included in this program transcribed were Douglas Dumbrill, Dick Elliott, and Dick Ryan. The part of Julius was played by Walter Tetley. This has been an NBC Radio Network presentation.
That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more old-time radio. I hope you can join us then. Till then, this is Jim Dolan, thanking you for listening.